It's Monday, April 20. Good day. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. Today on the podcast, Norm Coleman back in the news for helping moderate Republicans. A look at the week ahead at the state capitol. Target wants to get to know you better. A Minnesota author is also an artist, and a stonemason shapes St. Paul. First, federal authorities have charged six men with conspiring or attempting to travel to join the ISIS terrorist group fighting in Syria. Authorities arrested the six in multiple operations in Minneapolis and San Diego yesterday. A criminal complaint recounts the men's efforts to get from Minneapolis to airports in New York and California, intending to travel from there to Europe or Asia and eventually the Middle East. U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger says these men worked over the last 10 months to join ISIS.
We have a terror recruiting problem in Minnesota. And this case demonstrates how difficult it is to put an end to recruiting here. Parents and loved ones should know that there is not one master recruiter organizing in the Somali community locally.
The complaint alleges that some of the men were in touch with Abdi Nur, a Twin Cities man who left the country last year and has been presumed fighting with ISIS. A memorial for Barway Collins drew more than 300 people yesterday afternoon. The event was put on by a group that searched for the 10-year-old boy who went missing on March 18th. His body was found in the Mississippi River over a week ago. Among the memorial crowd was Vivian Tiwia of Brooklyn Park.
It's very sad. It breaks my heart, to be honest. That you're just a 10-year-old kid. I'm a Liberian myself, so it's just kind of, it affects the entire Liberian community as a whole. Nobody deserved to die, especially a child, innocent child.
After the service, the crowd walked down to the Mississippi and dropped white roses into the water. Collins' father has been charged with second-degree murder. A new University of Minnesota study supports the idea that biodiversity can help ecosystems thrive. Elizabeth Dunbar has more.
The study published in the journal Science analyzed 28 years' worth of data from grasslands where scientists used fire, fertilizer, and other human influences and watched their impacts. They found that those influences mattered the most to plant growth when they also affected the diversity of plant species. The university's Forrest Isbell is a study co-author. He says the study suggests diversity helps ensure reliable plant growth over time, which could have important implications for agriculture.
It's hard to know whether there will be a drought this year coming up, but we still have to plant something now. And so this diversity is becoming increasingly appreciated as something that can help us hedge our bets against unpredictable environmental variability.
The experiments took place at the Cedar Creek Ecosystem Science Reserve near East Bethel. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The American Action Network may or may not ring a bell for you as the source of many political attack ads against Democrats during the election season. The group was founded by former Republican Senator Norm Coleman after his defeat in 2008 by Democrat Al Franken. Now, the American Action Network is launching a new initiative to defend Republicans against criticism from the party's right flank. Brett Neely has more.
The American Action Network's ads are generally attack ads against Democrats, which makes this latest ad campaign a bit surprising. The group's new ads on TV, radio, mail, and online praise 76 sitting Republican members of Congress, often from safe districts, for their recent votes for budget Medicare bills.
Recognize these two? You should. I'll give you a hint. They voted for the House Republican balanced budget plan.
When asked about the purpose of the ads, Norm Coleman says Republicans need to stop thinking and acting like a pure opposition party.
Our vision is to create and sustain a governing conservative majority.
Coleman, now also a lobbyist in Washington with clients that include Airbus and Saudi Arabia, used variations of that phrase, governing conservative majority, dozens of times during a 15-minute interview. Carleton College political science professor Stephen Scheer says the American Action Network is stepping in to support House Speaker John Boehner at a time when other outside groups on the Republican side are pushing members to vote against many of the GOP leadership's bills.
What they're trying to do is counterbalance that with positive and negative messages that will, they hope, move the Republican Party towards competent mainstream governance as they define it.
The American Action Network has spent more than $3 million on ads since January, all aimed at Republicans. By comparison, the group spent $11 million during the 2014 elections. Its beneficiaries have included Minnesota Congressman Tom Emmer, who's taken flack from his Tea Party supporters for some of his votes. Some of the money has also been spent on tough ads directed at fellow Republicans who are in favor of shutting down the Department of Homeland Security over President Obama's executive actions on immigration.
But some in Washington are willing to put our security at risk by jeopardizing critical security funding. That's the wrong message to send to our enemies.
Scheer says the message should be loud and clear to House Republicans.
Their negative ads that target the most conservative members are telling those members that they are being watched by people with political resources who can make life difficult for them.
Coleman says one of the American Action Network's goals is to prevent another government shutdown that would harm the GOP's standing with voters ahead of next year's presidential elections.
Shutting down the government is not a good thing. It's not a good thing for conservatives. We take the blame for that.
And he insists the ads have nothing to do with conservative outside groups, such as the Club for Growth and Heritage Action.
We're not looking to pick fights with anybody.
Those groups don't necessarily see things the same way. Dan Holler is a spokesman for Heritage Action, an arm of the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says Coleman's group is clearly stepping into the factional fight that's been underway within the GOP for years.
It looks like they're trying to bloody up conservatives for a potential primary challenge.
Holler questions the American Action Network's conservative credentials. Coleman's group isn't required to disclose its donors, but IRS records show donations from trade associations representing the oil and pharmaceutical industries. Holler says the group is merely an arm of big business interests looking to curry favor with Republican leaders rather than an expression of what GOP voters want.
I think it's a losing effort. It's not where the base of the party is. It's not where the power of the party comes from. It's not where the enthusiasm of the party comes from. But they're going to try. I think ultimately they're going to lose.
Coleman rejects that criticism and says the House Republicans the American Action Network supports are committed to a conservative but pragmatic approach to governing that voters should know about.
We think that people deserve a pat on the back for that, and so we're in a position to do it, and that's what we're doing.
Coleman says Republicans have to move beyond their image as the party of no, and that's what his group is trying to promote to voters. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
Republicans in the Minnesota House have released their plan for providing $2 billion in tax cuts. This week at the state capitol, the full House and Senate began voting on a series of financial bills that will shape the next two-year budget. But there are big differences between the budget bills that House Republicans are advancing and the bills that Senate Democrats are advancing. Kathy Werzer talked about it with state capitol reporter Tim Pugmire.
Let's start with that House tax bill. What's in it?
Well, there's a lot in it, as you can imagine, to get to $2 billion in cuts. We've been hearing a lot about some of these provisions for several weeks. Here are some of the highlights: new tax breaks on Social Security benefits and military retirement pay, as well as the contributions to college savings plans. It establishes a new tax-exempt savings plan for long-term care, also raises the threshold for estate taxes. There's an expansion of the child care tax credit, but far less than what DFL Governor Mark Dayton has proposed. And a big section of the bill is the property tax provisions that were finalized on Friday. About $500 million in property tax cuts for farmers and businesses, mostly, though, from a phase-out of the statewide business property tax levy. And then there's also that $85 million cut in local government aid to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth.
What budget bills are getting floor votes this week?
Well, the Senate has two scheduled today, their State Department's Veterans Bill and the Higher Education Bill. The House has its Transportation Funding Bill scheduled for a floor vote on Tuesday. Other bills are either ready to go or soon will be ready to go and haven't yet been scheduled, but there will be something every day this week. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach said he thinks all the budget bills will be off the Senate floor by the end of the month, and the House seems to be moving at a similar pace.
Where's the Health and Human Services bill? I know that there's a lot of interest in that one.
Right. Well, there are committee hearings today in the House and Senate for the separate versions of the bill, but most of the attention has been on this House bill, which would reduce projected spending by more than $1 billion and eliminate the MinnesotaCare program. However, the House Ways and Means Committee is poised to put some more money into the HHS bill today, a $140 million adjustment in the target.
How soon do you think negotiations could then start between the House and the Senate and the governor on the budget bills?
Well, as soon as these bills for specific budget areas are passed in both chambers, then the House and Senate leaders appoint the conference committees to begin resolving the differences. Some big differences, however. Transportation looks like it'll be the toughest, with the House refusing to raise the gas tax that the Senate and the governor rely on in their proposals. State government funding could also be a challenge. The House has left out the payments for the new Senate office building. A lot of differences in a lot of bills. Still, House Speaker Kurt Dowd said on Friday that he thinks negotiations will go smoothly and the session will end on time.
And where's the money for the bird flu outbreak tucked away in one of those bills?
Well, it's being put into the agriculture bills moving through the House and Senate for a long-term response. But last week, the House waived its rules and passed a short-term emergency funding measure of $900,000 from the current budget to help out two of the state agencies responding to the outbreak. The Senate is expected to do the same this week, and the Senate Finance Committee is discussing that emergency funding measure today.
All right, Tim Pugmeier. Have a good week.
Thanks, you too.
Minneapolis-based Target knows its customers pretty well. The retailer has long tracked purchases, looked for clues about other things a shopper might want to buy, but the retailer intends to get much better at learning about customers and using that knowledge to encourage them to spend more. Martin Moylan has more.
Target's chief of strategy and innovation, Casey Carl, recently told a gathering of investors the company needs to know its customers even better.
Data and analytics is one of the capabilities where we know we need to make up ground quickly.
Carl said Target would create an internal center of excellence for data analysis. He said the center will yield more personalized email marketing, more tailored promotions, and personalized offers delivered to the company's Cartwheel smartphone app. Cartwheel has some 13 million users, about the population of the state of Illinois.
We're going to continue to improve on the mobile experience in a number of ways this year. In-store location and navigation capabilities, greater mobile payments integration, and testing new technologies like iBeacons to make shopping even more personalized.
Never heard of iBeacons? Here's how one vendor pitches it in a YouTube video.
You could be out for a stroll when your phone gets a notification from a nearby store. It's enticing, so you go in to check it out. Upon entering, an employee greets you.
In the animated video, the customer is greeted by name.
As you make your way around the store, you notice a product you really like. The beacon recognizes you're near the product and delivers a coupon straight to your phone.
iBeacons will be new to Target and its customers, but they're just the next step for a company that works hard to find out what its customers will buy. Target's privacy policies say the company tracks customers' transactions, browsing on its website and social media sites, and other actions to help craft personalized offers to shoppers. A few years ago, a Target executive disclosed that the retailer could determine which individual customers account for about half of its in-store sales, most of its online sales, and a quarter of the browsing on Target websites. Those numbers are likely higher now with growing use of Target-branded debit and credit cards. But Target also draws lines. The company is deploying mannequins in about 1,000 stores, but not the kind with cameras that can detect the age, sex, and other characteristics of shoppers. On the other hand, you don't need spy mannequins or iBeacons to get a lot of useful data. University of Minnesota technology expert Ravi Bapna says cell and Wi-Fi data from mobile devices could let Target effectively watch shoppers browse a store, seeing what items they're interested in and what may make them buy something or not. It's akin to watching shoppers move through a website.
With the mobile phone, you get similar kinds of richness of data.
Bapna expects companies to harvest and act on whatever information they can, as long as they don't overstep legal boundaries and social standards.
The boundaries of what can be collected and what will be integrated are sort of getting pushed every day.
A few years ago, Target was widely chastised after a Target executive revealed the retailer could tell when women were pregnant. Discretion and diplomacy is important in data mining if you want to avoid spooking people. Dave Marcotte is Senior Vice President for Retail Insights Americas for Kantar Retail.
What you don't want to do is get into situations where you're predicting behavior and informing the customer of that predicted behavior before it's rational. I'm glad to hear you're going to become pregnant, is you're definitely on the wrong side of the line.
Many people freely hand over useful information. People who sign up for Target's baby, wedding, and college registries offer up lots of tips about what they might buy. And shoppers such as Sarah Urbis of Burnsville don't mind the company's tracking.
I get coupons in the mail, and they seem to be a little bit more tailored to what we would possibly buy. I understand that they're just trying to do their best at serving their customer, and in order to do that, they need to know our shopping trends.
And that's the attitude that Target is betting most consumers will have. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Internationally acclaimed author Louise Erdrich has put together her first ever show of visual art. She has created an interactive gallery experience that includes large found object sculptures, paintings, and audio recordings. Marianne Combs reported on Friday evening.
Louise Erdrich sits in Boakley Gallery, just a few doors down from her bookstore, Birchbark Books, in the Kenwood neighborhood of Minneapolis. She watches a trio of women take in her sculptures and paintings. One woman picks up a vintage telephone and listens intently. Erdrich smiles.
It's been a dream of mine to have a reading where I don't have to be present. Now, I'm so happy. I don't have to be here, and people can walk in. They can pick up the phones, and I can read to them while they're looking at something. So I've had such a great time with this.
The show, called Asynchronous Reading, features several telephones placed throughout the gallery, each offering a different message.
Hello. Oh, thanks for answering my call. I'm so surprised and disturbed. Not exactly in a bad way, but...
The gallery is dominated by three large sculptures of women made from things Erdrich has collected over the years. Feathers, bones, a miniature birch bark canoe. Erdrich points to a brilliant blue sculpture with a square picture frame for a head, filled with star charts, an old French cigarette pack, and a gumball stuck in a shot glass. She laughs as she explains it's a self-portrait. While this is Erdrich's first ever gallery show, she's not a newcomer to visual art. She illustrated several of her children's books. She's made found object sculptures since her college days. And she says she's long been interested in painting. Two of her paintings in the gallery look almost like textiles with blue and red lines running through them. She says she initially used them to work out literary problems.
So the paintings with the lines are ways for me to think about lines, which is what writers do. They think about each line without using any words. But eventually the painting became about itself.
Mixed through the exhibition is artwork by two of her daughters. Her daughter Aza contributed several paintings, one of which was used for the cover art of Erdrich's National Book Award-winning novel, The Roundhouse. Her daughter Pallas created several short videos, as well as what Erdrich calls a reassuringly detailed flowchart of the afterlife. Her sister Hyde Erdrich, an accomplished poet, curated the show. She says for a while she and Louise were torn over the form it would take.
She kept wanting to sew all the images together and make some sort of narrative arc with it. And I was, as a curator, I've said, well, they don't have to all connect so directly. So we came up with the idea that we were investigating not a murder mystery, but life's mysteries. And I decided to install the Agency Epiphany as part of this work.
The Agency Epiphany is an installation off in one corner of the gallery. It consists of a worn farmhouse kitchen table that's been converted into a desk upon which a restored typewriter sits. To the side are files that visitors can read, marked table of contents, findings, and backstories. They include Hyde's, or Agent H, as she's known in the installation, writings in response to Louise's works, sometimes in the form of poetry. Visitors to the gallery can leave their own responses as well. An epiphany, Hyde Erdrich explains, is a sort of mistaken epiphany. When someone has an epiphany, they suddenly have a deep understanding of something. When someone has an epiphany, they think they understand the meaning of something, but they're wrong.
To me, those seem natural because they really are metaphor in a way, you know, and a poet deals in metaphor.
Asynchronous Reading is at Boakley Gallery through April 25th. Louise Erdrich is giving an artist talk tonight. The Erdrichs have also created a website, agencyapophany.com, for those who can't experience the show in person. Hyde Erdrich says she hopes people will be inspired to think about how artists cross boundaries and genres.
For every, you know, beautiful novel they've enjoyed from Louise, somewhere there's a series of artworks or boxes full of notes and beautiful things. She's just a consummate artist. There's no other way to say it. Every bit of her life is beautiful. And she makes things beautiful.
I'm Marianne Combs, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And now this about art. Kathy Werzer with the intro.
Mark Wickstrom is not a typical artist. Instead of brushes or clay, he uses an industrial air compressor. In his studio, it's five stories of scaffolding wrapped around the Minnesota State Capitol.
We've got a very high bar that we have to maintain because we have to keep our work the same caliber as those original craftsmen, and that's no easy task.
Wickstrom is one of a handful of carvers climbing around outside the building, restoring the stone on the Capitol, originally designed by architect Cass Gilbert. It's in tough shape after more than 100 Minnesota winters. NPR's Tim Nelson climbed up to see how it's done.
Mark Wickstrom took the long way to stone carving.
I grew up on the Iron Range, a little town called Meadowlands. And I grew up on a farm, and we were making the hay and milking the cows and all that kind of stuff.
His dad worked in the taconite mines and was an explosives technician. His mom was a cook and a janitor at the high school. Wickstrom himself grew up and became a bricklayer. And then his union asked him if he'd like to go to Europe and try his hand at stone carving. He eventually wound up in France training as an apprentice on the 800-year-old cathedral in Reims.
The stone carvers I learned from on the cathedral, they give you very simple tasks like squaring a block to begin with. Then you might do an arch stone, but it's got to be perfect. 1 millimeter plus or minus, and that's not much leeway.
But there's plenty of opportunity to practice in Reims.
Yeah, actually, when I was working on the cathedral, I asked one of my coworkers how much work do you think we have left here? And he said, I don't know, maybe 85 or 115 years, because it's an ongoing process. Considering all the coronations for the kings, a lot of them held there, that they have to continually maintain it.
Now he lives in Eden Prairie, and he's one of just three master cutter carvers in the U.S. certified in the ancient art of carving marble, granite, and other architectural stone.
What they say in the trade is there's a young man that got bit by the stone bug. After that, you don't want to do anything else. It's hard to look at a concrete block and say, oh yeah, I'm all excited about laying that. I would rather carve.
He's 56 now and has been doing just that for more than a dozen years. The last two on a carving crew with Twin City Tile and Marble. That's one of the companies doing stonework at the state capitol. His job is to make models of the original stonework details and send them out to have rough copies made by machine. Another crew saws away the damaged parts and glues the new stone into place. Wickstrom comes along behind, smoothing the new into the old in a whole catalog of details, some no bigger than a postage stamp.
This is an acanthus leaf. I think you have 16 different acanthus leaves. This is abacus. This is called a floron, and this is actually the state flower right here in the center. That's part of the design. And you've got some scrolls.
There are volutes and bush hammer marks, too. And it all has to be completed by hand with tiny grinders the size of a cookie pop and air-powered chisels that are a little bigger than a smartphone. The chisels make about 30 taps a second, much faster than a handheld hammer. But there's a limit to how much machines can help, Wickstrom says.
I'm kind of old school myself. I think machines can do all kinds of wonderful things, and you can walk away from them, program them. But a machine doesn't have a heart and a conscience. It can only take you so far, but it still takes a craftsman to put the final touches on it.
A conscience? For stone carving? Wickstrom says it's about the work that no one, but maybe pigeons, might ever see up close.
You really have to put that out of your mind about what it looks like from the ground. It has to look right here. And that's the way they felt about their work. So it's kind of a code that we have to hold up.
He and his colleagues will be doing that for about two more years, working their way slowly around the columns and pilasters around the building. They're retracing the most permanent of records, written in stone by hands long dead.
it's kind of a strange deal. It's like seeing the same patient every day when you're a doctor. Basically, we've kind of adapted this attitude where this is my target today, and this has to be brought back to what it was. And when I'm done with this one, I move to this one, and there will be another one. And you just meticulously go through day after day after day, and somehow it all seems sane.
From the facade on the Minnesota State Capitol, Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the NPR News Update podcast for Monday. I'm Phil Picardi, back in the saddle. I'll have the news here on Tuesday.